Tonight we're on the ninth section, Who Do You Say That I Am? Reasons for Jesus' Crucifixion. You can download the outline online and follow along through the PowerPoint presentations through the online download. First of all, the key question for tonight that we're going to be asking is, why did Jesus die? And the answer to that question is actually kind of complicated. You have a whole mix of history, politics, and theology all mixed together in answering that question. We're going to try to divide it up into different parts and take a look at it in terms of slices of the puzzle. But the first key question that we're going to be looking at tonight is, why did the Roman authorities execute Jesus? Pontius Pilate and the Roman government. And then secondly, why did the Jewish leadership seek to have Jesus executed? And then finally, we're going to finish up looking at, did Jesus himself intend to go and die on the cross? And why, if he did, why did he envision that he was going to die in the manner in which he did? We'll look at what, in terms of Jesus' intention of his death, the key symbol that he used to interpret his death. That being, of course, I'll let you guess. What do you think of the key symbol of Jesus' death that he used to interpret? What's that? Well, the cross was the actual event, but what did he use as a symbolic picture of what he was doing on the cross? I'll give you a hint. We do it every single week. It's not my preaching. It's the other half of the worship service. Communion, the Last Supper. The bread and the wine. That the Lord's Supper was the key symbol that he used to point to his coming death. And so we'll look at some of the sayings surrounding that symbol, and also the focus of eschatological redemption in Judaism and the strange victory. We'll take a look at those two sections next week. So let's take a look first at the Roman charge. Why did Jesus die from the Roman perspective? First of all, when it comes to the cross, it was invented primarily by the Romans as a means of execution and cruel and hideous torture. It would never fly in the sense of cruel and unusual punishment. It is perhaps the most horrific way of executing somebody that anybody has ever dreamed up. It took quite a long time for a person to die. It was excruciatingly painful. You actually die by means of suffocation as you are lifting yourselves up on the nails on your arms to get a breath of air, and that's so painful to take that breath of air as those nails are pulling on your arms and your tendons and everything, and then you let yourself down, and of course you can't breathe when you're in the down position, and so you push yourself up back with your feet and your hands, and you go up back and forth. That's why sometimes as an act of mercy, these Roman soldiers would break the legs of the prisoners because that would actually hasten the process of their death so that they couldn't push themselves back up and they would just go ahead and suffocate and die. But just the act of suffocating itself was a horrific form of punishment. But to be suffocated in such a cruel way with other pains and things and so forth. Not to mention the fact that they would often, as in the case of Jesus, flog the person before they put him on a cross, so their back is full of all these wounds. So as they're rubbing up and down against that wood, it is rubbing up against and down against those wounds. So it is a very cruel form of punishment. And the Romans used it very proficiently as a way of keeping order within the Roman Empire. When they talked about the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, it was a peace that was was enforced by the sword and by the cross. Everybody knew what it meant to pick up your cross when Jesus uttered those words. It meant that you would end up on a Roman instrument of torture and death. It was a symbol that said, we are the ones in charge around here. You are our property. We can do to you whatever the heck we want to do to you. And you don't have anything that you can do about it. We are the ones that are running the show. And it symbolized for everybody the absolute sovereignty of Caesar and Rome. It says to anybody who walks down a road and you see a Roman crucifixion and a person being crucified, it says very clearly, we are the ones that are in charge around here, and this is what we do to anybody who is a threat to that authority. So Jesus actually would have grown up as he grew up in Nazareth, there was a village, Sepphoris, where the Romans crucified the whole town for its rebelliousness. So the people were very familiar with what Roman crucifixion was all about and what it meant from a Roman perspective. It was primarily used to deal with rebellion and sedition against the Roman authority and emperor. So the charge for Jesus was a charge of sedition, of political insurrection against Rome. That's why he was crucified by the Roman authorities. He was one more in a long line of would-be messiahs and would-be rebels against the Roman authority who would have these great aspirations that they would be able to stand up against the Roman oppressors and overthrow them. From the standpoint of who ends up on a cross, it's insurrectionists. And that's why Jesus was crucified. That was his charge of what put him on that Roman cross. Examples are plentiful. You can look these people up in your own time, but examples might be a Judas the Galilean or Simon Bar Giora, and you can take a look at those people. Maybe they might be in Wikipedia, but there are plentiful examples of people who were insurrectionists. Jesus Barabbas that was hanging next to Jesus on the cross, or that was released in Jesus' stead, would have been an insurrectionist. While his accusers handed him over and Pilate executed him on this charge, both Jesus' accusers and Pontius Pilate knew that he actually was not guilty of it. He was not leading any type of political insurrection group. I mean, not in at least in the sense of militarily. Certainly the message that Jesus was promoting and teaching had political implications. Yahweh is king. Yahweh's kingdom is coming. That had a very clear message to anybody who would set themselves up as a king or exalt themselves. But he was not calling upon anybody to rebel against Roman authority. Quite the contrary. He was teaching his disciples to, if a Roman soldier came and asked you to carry his bags for a mile, which was a thing that a Roman soldier could do to anybody he wanted to, Jesus told his disciples that they should offer to take the Roman soldier's bags for 2 miles. So Jesus was challenging his disciples to be not only peaceful in the way that they related to the Romans, but actually generous and gracious to them and loving towards their enemies. You have a question, Rob?
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember in one of our Thursday morning things we went over, it wasn't Peter, that Christ had always said to respect the leadership and to follow what the leadership said.
Right. How could he have been what?
How could he have ended up being an insurrectionist when he taught to follow the leadership?
Right, well that's kind of the puzzle of it, isn't it? Here he's crucified, that's the charge that is leveled against him, and here he's put on a Roman cross and crucified as an insurrectionist, but he's never actually told anybody to pick up arms against the Romans. And yet that's the charge by which he's crucified. That's why, from the standpoint of the Roman perspective, Jesus was crucified. He was crucified as a rebel against Caesar and a threat to Roman authority. And yet he never challenged anyone to pick up a military arm at all. He actually taught them the opposite, to carry their bags and to, if your enemy strikes you on the cheek, turn the other cheek. So, Pontius Pilate knew that Jesus was no threat to Rome, at least not in the standpoint of militarily, and yet crucified him anyway on that particular charge. And we get a picture of Pontius Pilate in the Gospels as being one who was not really about justice anyway, was he? He wasn't somebody that was interested in freeing innocent people. He could care less who he crucified or for what reason he crucified. There's an occasion, or Pontius Pilate has had a very much of a reputation, as you read, not just the sources in the Gospels, but also other historians of that time, of being provocative and bullying. Here's one of the Jewish historians, a man named Philo, his account of a situation where Pontius Pilate had hung these golden shields up in the Herodian palace, and a group of Jewish princes had come to Pilate and threatened him that if he didn't remove the shields, that they would report him to Tiberius. And the challenge, of course, for Pilate is he didn't want to do anything the Jewish people wanted him to do. Quite the contrary, he always wanted to do the opposite. If the Jewish leaders wanted him to do something, he wanted to do what they didn't want to do. And you get a sense of that in Philo's recounting of that scene. He feared that if they actually sent the embassy, they would expose the rest of his conduct as governor by stating in full the briberies, the insults, the robberies, the outrages, the wanton injustices, the executions without trial, constantly repeated, the ceaseless and supremely grievous cruelty. So with all his vindictiveness and furious temper, he was in a difficult position. He had not the courage to take down what had been dedicated, nor did he wish to do anything which would please his subjects. But at the same time, he knew full well the constant policy of Tiberius in these matters. So here's a situation that's not unlike where Jesus is faced in the Gospels, where Pilate faced in the Gospel recounting, where here he knows what the Jewish subjects are wanting, and that is to remove those shields from the Herodian palace, but he doesn't want to do it because that's what they want, and he doesn't want to do anything that will please them. But he's also got this, he knows the policies of Tiberius that would discourage things like that, and so they're threatening to go over his head and tell on him, and so he's between that rock and the hard place and not knowing what to do. It's almost exactly what happened with him and Jesus. You could almost substitute the whole scene here of him not wanting to please the Jews, not wanting to crucify Jesus because that's what they want. They wanted to crucify Jesus, so he wants to free him because they want to crucify him. He doesn't want to do what they're wanting to do and doesn't want any part of their issues. And yet, at the same time, they go, well, we're going to go and we're going to tell Caesar that you're no friend of Caesar. You're betraying the emperor by not dealing with these insurrectionists. Pontius Pilate would certainly not have seen Jesus as a threat. He would not have wanted to do what the Jewish leaders wanted, that's for certain. But they understood how to push his buttons and to leverage their own weakness by threatening to go over his head to the emperor. And they leveraged his need and fear, fearful submission to the emperor. If you don't let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Now remember Pontius Pilate's little backhanded way of getting back at the Jews. He put up a sign that said, the King of the Jews. And you remember they didn't want it to say, the King of the Jews. They wanted it to say, this man claimed to be the King of the Jews. But he says, no, I'm going to make it say, the King of the Jews, as a way of sticking it to him and twisting the knife. Okay, so you want me to crucify him? Well, I'm going to crucify your king. But they wanted to think of Jesus as a poser king. Now, that's an interesting little thing right here. I don't know if you probably can't read what that says. But the up there it says Tiberium, who is the emperor. And then right there is the N-U-S, Pontius, or T-U-S, Pilatus, P-I-L-A-T-U-S. This is the stone that they discovered in Caesarea Maritime, I think about 40 years ago, 40 or 50 years ago. And up to that point, there was actually no archaeological evidence of Pontius Pilate's existence. And that archaeological find was one of the things that validated the historicity of Pontius Pilate as a historic figure and showed, you know, that there were inscriptions and things with his name on it dating back to that time. One of the things that I realized when I went and visited Israel, and my guide told me this, is that I think he said something like 80% of Israel is unexcavated. And so there is a tremendous amount of archaeological discoveries yet to be made. And the archaeological evidence that we are working with is very limited in its scope. Now, of course, they have excavated a lot of the more important sites, but nevertheless, there's a tremendous amount of archaeology and things left to discover, and so who knows what they will find in the future. And they're always discovering, you know, things, and so oftentimes these discoveries do validate much of what's in the scriptures. For a while, there was no archaeological evidence of the existence of a King David. And not too long ago, they discovered an archaeological inscription, not unlike this kind of thing, with David's name on it in Jerusalem around the temple complex and the palace complex. So they are doing some interesting archaeological work, and that's one of those examples of that. Remember, one of the things that's really not contested historically is the sign on the cross that Jesus is the King of the Jews, and it was put in Latin and Hebrew. The reason, or Aramaic, the reasons for Jesus' crucifixion, the Jewish charge. So the Jewish charge is a little more complex because, number one, they have to get to the point where they convince Pilate to charge him as a seditionist against Rome. But that's not what they want. They're actually upset with Jesus about. Quite the contrary, especially the Pharisees, if he was a seditionist against Rome, they probably would have been in favor of that. So the charge that they bring to Pilate is actually the opposite of what they were frustrated with him about, at least one of the groups. Remember, when you think about the political context of Israel at that time, as it would be in any time, humanity doesn't divide itself into one ideology or one perspective. There are parties. And your Pharisees would have been, say, your conservative, somewhat more of your hawkish kind of group that would have been very much in favor of bringing things back to that good old time Torah-based religion, and would have had no problem if there was a well-organized military leader that would organize the people to go to arms against Rome. They probably would have jumped right on that and supported that kind of effort. Now, some other parties in the mix, the Sanhedrin was the Jewish council, and so that was the establishment group, the high priest and so forth. Now, some of those may have been of the Pharisee party, but some of those may also have been Sadducees, which tended to be the more liberal group. Now, you can't go one-to-one, our conservatives are like their conservatives, our liberals are like their liberals, or you can't do that kind of thing historically. But just generally speaking, that is a good way to think about it, that the Sadducees tended to be more worldly in a sense, less supernatural based. There was also a group called the Herodians, which were very deeply compromised with Rome as the Roman puppet state, and they were the people who supported Herod and his regime. So you had these different parties that were interacting with each other. And the interesting thing, when it came to Jesus, they were all unified in opposition to him. For different reasons, but they all came to the same conclusion, that we don't want this guy around. Which is interesting, and I think, you know, fast forward to our time, I think that might be an interesting commentary on our current political parties and situation, is maybe Jesus might have something to say to all of the different groups in the political process and the way we chop ourselves up. But you have to, as you're thinking about the Jewish charge, move from what Jesus did in the temple action, because certainly that act of going into Jerusalem on the and that whole complex of actions, you know, riding in on the donkey, going into the temple, throwing over the tables, accusing them of turning the house of prayer for the nations into a den of banditos and robbers. To you have to go from there to the questions that we talked about last week of messiahship, where Jesus seems to be, in his discussions and interactions with all those Jewish rulers and authorities, hinting at, with his riddles and questioning and their questioning of him, what it's all driving at is, you think you're the Messiah, and you're doing the kinds of things that are messianic, you're saying the kinds of things that are messianic, everything's pointing to the fact that you are claiming to be the Son of God. And you remember the culmination of that discussion was Jesus before Caiaphas, the high priest, where he point blank asks him, are you the Son of God? Meaning, are you the Messiah? Do you think of yourself as the Messiah? And of course, Jesus says, yes, I do. And so the questions about messiahship, so you go from the temple action to the questions and interactions trying to drive Jesus to admit that he is in fact the Son of God and sees himself as the King of Israel, to that trial before Pilate. So how does all of that progress in the intentions of the Jewish authorities? We have to get to the point where Pilate asks, are you the King of the Jews? Because that's the question that has been put before him. And everything leads to that question. Why would the Jewish authorities determine to get rid of Jesus? So here's what we're going to try to answer. Why would the Jewish authorities determine to get rid of Jesus? Well, the Jewish authorities for themselves, and this would have carried absolutely no weight with Pontius Pilate, but it was their justification for why Jesus was a problem, would have thought of Jesus along the lines of Deuteronomy chapter 13. If a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you, announces to you a sign or wonder, and if the sign or wonder spoken of takes place, and the prophet says, let us follow other gods, gods you have not known, and let us worship them, you must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. That prophet or dreamer must be put to death for inciting rebellion against Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. That prophet or dreamer tried to turn you away from the way of the Lord your God commanded you to follow. You must purge the evil from among you. So, from the Jewish authorities' perspective, they saw Jesus as one who was leading Israel astray. The Babylonian Talmud, which is a Jewish document of that period, would have said this about Jesus. Jesus was hanged on the eve of the Passover. The herald went before him for 40 days, saying he's going to be stoned because he practiced sorcery and enticed and led Israel astray. Let everyone knowing anything in his defense come and plead for him. But nothing was found in his defense, so he was hanged on the eve of the Passover. From the Jewish perspective, Jesus was a false teacher and a false prophet. This is very different from the way a modern American people talk about Jesus. They try to say, well, he was just a good teacher, he was a good prophet, but that was not the view, the Jewish view back then. It was not that he was just a decent preacher and teacher, but not the Son of God. That's very often when we try to build those Christian Jewish relationships, we create these kind of nice categories that, well, we can be friends because you thought that Jesus was just a prophet, but you didn't really think he was the Messiah. That's not what the Jewish people of that time thought. They thought he was a false prophet, that he was leading Israel astray. They wouldn't have ever said that he's a good teacher, he's just not the Messiah. It was one or the other for Jesus. Oh, that's really tiny. The Jewish charge at issue, Jesus' speech and symbolic action against the temple and the Torah. This is the fundamental problem that they had with Jesus. He, in his teachings, in his actions, in everything that he was doing, was speaking against the cherished symbols of Israel, namely the temple, and this would of course been what would have upset the establishment, and the Torah, which would have upset the Pharisees. The Pharisees would have had a lot of critiques of the establishment and would have been fine with the destruction of the temple as long as you were going to rebuild the right one. Of course, those who were the current temple priests and scribes and so forth, they would have not wanted to destroy the temple. They would have been against anything that would have led to the destruction of the temple. So you have these mixed motivations, but Jesus is stepping on everybody's toes when it comes to the Jewish people leadership of that day, and especially those cherished symbols. The interesting thing is that what he was doing with respect to those symbols, and we talked about this several lessons ago when we talked about the symbols of Israel and how Jesus redefined them, is that he took those cherished symbols, the temple, Torah, family, land, etc., and he reinterpreted them completely in terms of himself. He is the true temple and temple builder. He is the one who fulfills Torah. And so he takes what would have been Jewish loyalty to temple, Torah, land, family, etc., and redirects it, redefines it. So loyalty to temple, Torah, land, family is all loyalty to Jesus. Now that kind of thing was offensive to those who held those cherished symbols. So when he did the works of power that went along with his teaching, the miraculous healings and the driving out demons and so forth, that people were actually able to see those miraculous things that he was doing, those deeds of power, rather than interpret those of works of God, they interpret them as sorcery, works of the devil. You remember I told you the story about the young Jewish guy that tried to get me to do the Hanukkah prayers in the airport in Tel Aviv, and when I outed that I was a Christian and said I don't know how to read Hebrew and so forth, he started to tell me I was wrong because Jesus was a sorcerer, that he was doing magic, and I was like, I caught me off guard. I never heard a Jewish person tell me that Jesus was doing magic. I said, so what did he do that was magic? And he said he flew. And I guess it's referring to the ascension. Yeah.
Because to his Jewish mind, anything, both of those other religions are sometimes mixed up in their minds. They don't really separate them as much.
Sure. Well, certainly what he had been taught was actually more along the lines of what that Babylonian Talmud says. That Jesus was practicing sorcery. And that's what they said about him. That he's driving out these demons by the hand of Satan, that he is in league with Beelzebub and doing the works of Beelzebub, who is the chief of demons. So this would have been the heart of their charge. They also had to deal with the fact that the general populace was actually kind of excited about somebody like Jesus, especially if he was going to lead them into some type of victorious assault against the Roman government. So the general populace was wanting Jesus to be the kind of revolutionary that if Pilate caught him, would would put him on a cross. They actually were looking for a Jesus that would be that kind of Jesus. So the Jewish authorities needed a reason to discredit Jesus to the general populace, the general Jewish populace, and at the same time meet the requirements of Roman execution. And it's kind of a catch-22, because if you call him an insurrectionist, well, then the populace is behind him, and you're coming, and the Roman authorities or the Jewish authorities are coming out against him for what the people want. But if they say he's something other than that, so what they do is they come up with these charges that he is leading people astray, that he is a false teacher and a false prophet in doing sorcery. Pilate would not care about the leading Israel astray. He could give a flip about that. That's irrelevant to him. But the Jewish authorities opposed Jesus for different reasons. The Pharisees would oppose him because of his resistance to their militant Torah-centered nationalistic aspirations. The chief priests and the scribes would have other reasons. Because of Jesus' notoriety and popularity, he actually might stir up the Romans' wrath and come down on the official structures of the temple complex and the Jewish authorities as they were. So they were actually, in a sense, trying to keep the peace and keep the status quo as those in power. They wanted to, and in that way, they were deeply compromised with the Romans. So the chief priests and scribes opposed him for different reasons, but they came to the same conclusion. He's got to go. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. So the Sanhedrin, just so you get the terms, is the big Jewish council. That's their authoritative meeting. What are we accomplishing, they ask. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. So they were recognizing that Jesus was gaining some power with the populace, and that if they didn't do something about it, the Roman ire was going to come down on their heads with a vengeance. Ironically, that's exactly what happened, only it wasn't because of what Jesus was doing, it was because of their firebrand revolutionaries that came after him. John 11. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they ask. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. If we were putting that in terms of modern day language, better that we throw this one guy under the bus, right, than that we all get run over by the bus. So they wanted to use Jesus as a scapegoat, and we'll give him to the Romans so that we all can be spared. And it's really quite ironic that they thought that, because actually Jesus was the hope of those Jewish people and the Jewish leaders. And from Jesus' perspective, he was willing to bear the full wrath of Rome for their sake and to give them security, as we'll see in a minute. Luke 22. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. If you are the Messiah, they said, tell us. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of mighty God. And they asked, are you then the Son of God? Remember, we talked about what that means. That basically means, are you the Messiah? He replied, you say that I am. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? We've heard it from his own lips. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. They began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation." Now look at what the charge that they bring before Pilate. "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You've said so," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up all the people over all Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." So they aren't going to let Pilate let off the hook. Pilate probably would have just flogged him and threw him back. But they knew how to pull the political trump card out on Pilate, that he's no friend of Caesar. So the Jewish charge, he was sent to the Roman governor on a capital charge because many, not least many Pharisees, but also probably the chief priests, saw him as a false prophet leading Israel astray. Now that charge would not have held any sway with the Roman governor. But he was also sent to the Roman governor on a capital charge because as one of aspect of this, they saw the temple action as a blow against the central symbol not only of a national life, but also of Yahweh's presence with his people. And because though he was clearly not leading a real or organized military revolt, he saw himself as in some sense a Messiah and could thus become the focus of serious revolutionary activity. And because as the pragmatic focus of these three points, they saw him as a dangerous political nuisance whose actions might well call down the wrath of Rome on the temple and the nation alike. And then add to this what Jesus said about himself when he said, "And you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven and taking the throne of the Father in heaven." Now, remember, that was the icing on the cake for the Pharisees and for the chief priest. And they brought up the charge blasphemy at that point. Because he was, in that moment, and it could be interpreted this way, equivocating himself with God, with Yahweh and his throne. Because in the crucial moment in the hearing, he not only, as far as they were concerned, pleaded guilty to the above charges, but also did so in such a way as to place himself blasphemously alongside the God of Israel. So let's take a look now. Let me just stop there and see if you have any questions first, and we'll take a look at Jesus's intentions. We looked at the Roman and the Jewish reasons for crucifying Jesus. Any thoughts or questions? All right, we'll press on. We'll look at what Jesus thought about his own death. Did he have a view on it? Some people believe, as they, you know, the particularly those who have trouble with the historicity of the New Testament, think that Jesus never actually thought that he was going to die in that way. That he would have never have taught about his own crucifixion or his own death as some kind of having any kind of meaning. That this is the group that would consider Jesus just a wise sage that went around and taught wisdom to people, that he would have not attributed any type of eschatological or apocalyptic meaning to his death. Certainly that's not been what we've been advocating in this class. And we'll look at some of the sayings, and I think you'll find that they do make historic sense as we look at them too. Did Jesus intend to die in the manner that he did? And if so, why? Did Jesus go to Jerusalem simply to go and do a work, you know, to go and do miracles and more teaching and continue his wisdom ministry? Or did he actually go to Jerusalem intending to die? Was that his purpose in going to Jerusalem, was to accomplish that? If one of the places that we need to start with when we look at Jesus' intentions is the Last Supper scene. Now, we could say that this was not something that actually happened, but it was something that the early church invented and read back into the life of Jesus. But you, if you say that, you kind of have to ask, well, where did it come from? Where did the call to do, to completely reinterpret the Passover meal in terms of the crucifixion of Jesus, where did that happen? And you find that the teaching about the Last Supper is as early as the writings of the Apostle Paul. Paul mentions it in the book of Corinthians. So early 40s, 50s, early church, you have this tradition of the early Christians engaging in what we would call the rite of Last Supper. And so it's hard to not attribute that as something that Jesus encouraged his followers and disciples to do. And it makes sense in light of a lot of other things that Jesus taught and did and said. First of all, the Last Supper was, by what the New Testament says about it, connected to the Passover meal. It's questionable whether it actually occurred on the night that other Jewish people were eating the Passover. Especially the Gospel of John makes it sound like the meal was done maybe a day or so before the actual Jewish Passover evening when they would be celebrating, because the Gospel of John indicates that Jesus actually died on the Passover day. So you couldn't have had the Last Supper on the same day that you would have died. And the Passover day, you would have had the lamb be a component that was sacrificed at the temple on the day of the Passover, would have been a component of the Passover meal that night. But the Passover meal that Jesus celebrated had no lamb as part of it, at least no physical lamb. Let's not record it. We could ask the question why that is, but certainly Jesus does bring import and refers to this as a Passover meal and as preparation of a Passover meal. What happens at a Passover meal? Well, there's lots of symbolism in it. There were certain key symbols: bread, bitter herbs. The lamb are the primary ones. There's other ones that have been added to it since the time of Jesus, and other ones that probably are still being done. But there's a lot of different symbolism. But we'll look at the major ones. It all had to focus on what happened with the Israelites when they were rescued out of the hands of bondage in underneath Pharaoh. You remember the story of Moses? And he was called as a deliverer of the people of Israel, and he was sent to the Egyptian Pharaoh and told, "Let my people go." You remember that story? And of course, Pharaoh refused to let the Israelites go from the slavery. And a series of curses and plagues were announced, and every time the plague would happen, Pharaoh would kind of relent and say, "Okay, I'll let him go," but then he would renege and he wouldn't let him go. And it got to that most horrible of plagues, the Passover plague. Now, what was the Passover plague? The Israelites were commanded in the evening to take a lamb without spot or blemish. Every single Jewish household would take this lamb and sacrifice the lamb and take the blood from that lamb and spread the blood on their doorposts and on the mantle and the lintel of the doorposts. And so the angel of death would go through the land of Egypt, and every firstborn, man, woman, child, animals, would be struck down, unless the blood was over the door. Those who had the blood over the door would be spared. So even Pharaoh's son was killed that night. And of course, that was the last straw for Pharaoh. He sent them out and said, "Get out," and he gave them resources to flee with. And the Of course, after they left, Pharaoh again had a change of mind and went after them, pursued them up to the Red Sea. You know, the parting of the Red Sea, they go through the Red Sea, and everything happens, the rest of the story from there, the wandering through the wilderness and so forth. But that great act of salvation, judgment, redemption, all of that was to be remembered as an annual remembrance in the Passover celebration. And so the bitter herbs, for example, were to symbolize the bitter oppression under the yoke of Pharaoh. There's an interesting... let me fast forward here to the Passover meal spoke of leaving Egypt at the mighty hand of God. It pointed to a new exodus. So as the Israelites, future generations of Israelites, would eat the Passover meal, the children of those people would ask, why do we eat the bread? Why do we eat the bitter herbs and so forth? And everything would be explained to them. We eat unleavened bread because God redeemed us from the hand of Pharaoh, and we had to leave in haste, so we didn't have time to let the bread rise and all the yeast. And so we eat unleavened bread because we have to be quick and get out of here fast. And so this would be put into the mindset that God does mighty acts of salvation and redemption. He's done it in the past. Now, what would that mean to those who were in current bondage? That God would once again do that in the future. That He would restore Israel just as He did to our forefathers. He will one day rescue us from our sins. He will forgive us of our sins. He will save us from the hands of the oppressor. And He will again do another Passover. And He will judge our enemies. And He will fight our battles for us through the Red Sea and destroy the chariot armies. And He will take us in an act of deliverance and redeem His people again. And so the Passover meal not only looked backward in remembrance, but it also was one that gave hope and expectation of what God would do in the future. So for Jesus, as He did this new meal, or did the Passover meal, He indicated that the new Exodus was happening in and through Himself. We might suggest that it was necessary even then for Jesus not to celebrate the Passover on the regular night, because He was precisely not keeping it as simply one more meal in the sequence or one part of the regular Jewish cult dependent on the temple for the necessary sacrificial lamb. Where were we to find the lamb? Yahweh will provide, as He said to Abraham and Isaac. The Lord will provide. And indeed, He was providing with His very life. The temple action that Jesus engaged in judging the temple needs to be connected to what Jesus was doing in the upper room. Jesus was intending to replace the temple with His meal, or we could say it in another way, He was intending to replace the temple and all the sacrificial system of the temple with Himself. Now, a Passover meal would end with a hymn, and then you see that in the Gospel passages where we describe the Passover meal. I'll read one of them. Luke 22, "Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Jesus sent Peter and John saying, 'Go and make preparations for us to eat the Passover.' 'Where do you want us to prepare for it?' they ask. He replied, 'As you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters. Say to the owner of the house, the teacher asks, "Where is the guest room? Where may I eat the Passover with my disciples?" And he'll show you a large room upstairs, all furnished. Make preparation there." They left, found the things just as Jesus had told them, so they prepared the Passover. When the hour came, Jesus and His apostles reclined at the table, and He said to them, "I've eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." Now, what were some of the words that Jesus connected with the elements of the Passover meal? We find in the Gospels these similar statements. And they're also repeated in the Corinthians passage by Paul. When they were eating, Jesus took bread, and when He had given thanks, He broke it and gave it to His disciples, saying, "Take and eat. This is My body." The Luke passage. And He took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Now the difference, of course, is Luke adds that phrase "for you" and "do this in remembrance of me." Something a little bit different here. When we say the words of institution in church on Sundays, we oftentimes combine these different gospel readings together and synthesize them. So what was Jesus symbolizing here with the bread? Rabbi Gamliel, who was a contemporary at the time of Jesus and this particular period, a very famous rabbi, is quoted in the Mishnah in chapter 10, verse 5. "Whoever does not mention these three things on Passover does not discharge his duty. And these are they: the Passover offering, unleavened bread, the bitter herbs. The Passover offering is offered because the omnipresent one passed over the houses of our ancestors in Egypt." Now, the Passover offering is, of course, the lamb. Unleavened bread is eaten, and this is the part that I want to show you for this, because our ancestors were redeemed from Egypt. Now, go back. Jesus takes the bread, broke it, and then he reinterprets it in terms of his own body. "Take, eat, this is my body." Implication, go back to Gamliel. The bread is because our ancestors were redeemed from Egypt. Now it's my body that is redeeming you from Egypt. I am the Passover bread. Interesting. So then the bitter herb is eaten because the Egyptians embittered the lives of our ancestors in Egypt. So this is the meaning that is given to the Passover at the time of Jesus by Rabbi Gamliel. I don't know if you remember who Rabbi Gamliel was? He was the one that is in Acts that trained the Apostle Paul. That's right. He's a very famous rabbi. And one, I think his disciple was also Rabbi Hillel, which is often referred to as a famous Jewish rabbi also. So in every generation, this is continuing Gamliel here. In every generation, a person must regard himself as though he personally had gone out of Egypt. So see here, the remembrance of the Passover is to be applied as a present reality. It's like that past event gets imported in you to remember it as if you have gone through that event. It's that sort of imputation of the meaning of that event. And if you think about communion in this way, I'm kind of stepping out from N.T. Wright and some of the conclusions he draws and just drawing my own a little bit here. But if that verse there, you know, that every generation a person must regard himself as though he personally had gone out of Egypt. Now, as we celebrate communion up there and we are participating, just apply that phrase, that we are to regard ourselves as though who have personally have gone through that death and resurrection. You know, that we have, it's a personal appropriation that needs to take place every time we celebrate the meal. "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came forth out of Egypt." You are going to tell your children this. "Therefore, it's our duty to thank, praise, laud, glorify, exalt, honor, bless, extol, and adore him who performed all these miracles for our ancestors and us. He brought us forth from bondage into freedom, from sorrow into joy, from mourning into festivity, from darkness into great light, from servitude into redemption. Therefore, let us say before him, hallelujah." And that's how the Passover meal ends, is by singing the hymns, or the psalms of hallelujah, that are found at the end of the Psalter. And so the Passover meal is one of really entering into a personal sense that God has redeemed you personally from your sins, has shielded you with his grace and protection and forgiveness, and at the same time judged that which is evil and those who are opposed to the people of God and to God's purposes and kingship. Jesus takes all of that significance and applies it to himself. The bread of Yahweh's redemption of Israel, this is my body. I am the one who is redeeming Israel from Egypt. Again, the cup. When he took a cup and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." Now, I put that last part, "for the forgiveness of sins," in the parentheses there because it is in Matthew, but it's not in Mark. Mark doesn't have that last phrase, "for the forgiveness of sins." In Luke, in the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant." Now, that's different language slightly. The blood of the covenant, the new covenant. Now, that's making an explicit connection to many of those new covenant passages we looked at, like the ones from Ezekiel and Jeremiah. "The new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." Now, notice the difference. Matthew says, "poured out for many." Luke says, "poured out for you." There are minor differences, but when we and they emphasize different components, different aspects of emphasis. Both of them are true. Was poured out for many, but also, like Rabbi Gamil says, you have to personally appropriate the sacrifice that was made. It is for you personally, and it is for the many. Certainly, this passage from the Old Testament prophets would have been on the mind of Jesus when he is saying, "This is my blood of the new covenant," or "this is the blood of the covenant." Because why? He had just ridden into Jerusalem and made this whole scene here of riding on a colt on the foal of a donkey happen from Zechariah 10. So Jesus knew exactly about this passage, because he had just made that scene happen when he entered into Jerusalem in the triumphal entry with the hosannas being uttered. "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will take away the chariots from Ephraim, and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea, from the rivers to the end of the earth. As for you, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit." So when Jesus says, "Drink from it, all of you, this is my blood of the covenant. Because of the blood of my covenant," you see the connection? He is bringing about this passage or this prophetic utterance from Zechariah in the old covenant. And what is the purpose of the blood of my covenant? To free your prisoners from the waterless pit. In other words, this is a new exodus that is taking place, a new covenant, and it's a new covenant in blood of the one who is making the covenant. We also have that language of that I pointed out to you, which is poured out for many. Obviously, Matthew and Mark are picking up the language of Isaiah 53, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. The idea of the new covenant is in this one. And you remember Luke emphasized in his recounting of it, I'm sorry, Matthew emphasized the purpose for the forgiveness of sins. The passage from Jeremiah that we've looked at before about the new covenant: "The days are coming when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors." I'm going to fast forward down to verse 34. "No longer will they teach your neighbor or say to one another, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness and I will remember their sins no more." One of the critical components of the new covenant that was prophesied would be characterized by forgiveness of sins. And Jesus is saying that my death that is about to happen with his teaching his disciples through that powerful symbol of the Lord's Supper and the reinterpretation of the Passover meal, my death is what's going to bring about the new covenant. Jesus also brought into the Last Supper the sense of that eschatological perspective. In other words, there's a divine timing and a plan that is working its way out here. And this is the verse why we call it the Last Supper, because it is the last supper of the Old Covenant. It's the last Passover meal, is what Jesus is saying. No longer will you celebrate this meal as a remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt alone. The meal now is to be a remembrance of the mighty Exodus that I am going to accomplish in rescuing my people from their sins and from the bondage, not under a worldly oppressor, but under the oppression of Satan and spiritual oppression. I tell you, I will not drink from this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Matthew and Mark allude to subsequent new meals. Luke just implies that it's the last meal. For I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. You also have in the gospel accounts, and Paul also testifies to this remembrance of Jesus' encouragement of this. In 1 Corinthians, remember the letters of Paul were written before the gospels were written. So this is a recollection that the early Christians were keeping orally, and Paul puts it into writing into his letters. The utterance to do this in remembrance of me. And when he had given thanks, Paul says, he broke it and said, this is my body which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. So the establishment or the institution of this meal is to be a continual reminder for the people that Jesus is gathering together as his disciples, as a perpetual reminder of what he is accomplishing in dying at the hands of the Roman and Jewish authorities. So we find in that powerful symbol of the Lord's Supper Jesus intending to provide meaning to his own death. Now you also have in the sayings the connection to the symbol. The kingship of Yahweh was, and this is just a recap of, and pulling back out to the big picture again. The kingship of Yahweh was happening. This was what Jesus was announcing overall. The story of Israel was reaching its long-awaited goal in him and through him. That climactic moment where Israel would be finally, once and for all, rescued from its oppressors, taken out of bondage, restored, and the new covenant of God would come about. The climactic moment in redemptive history. What did Jesus think would happen next? Jesus was announcing the great moment had come. What would that moment look like? Well, we've talked about this at great length in other lectures, but you'll remember that Jesus envisioned a battle, but it was not against the pagans and the pagan oppressors. It was a battle against the enemies of both the pagans and the Jewish people. It was against the evil behind the evil, Satan and the spiritual forces of evil. His own clashes with the ruling authorities were part of that battle, as they, in his mind, had been duped by the Satan. So how would this real battle against the real enemy be fought? Jesus would teach a double revolution. First, turn the other cheek and go the extra mile versus taking up arms and fighting the Romans with force. Then, another assertion that Israel's God is at last becoming king in opposition to all who would oppose such an exaltation, and he's becoming king through the Messiah. And those two revolutionary statements come together and converge in a cross. Pick up your cross and follow me. So we find these passages which are riddles of the cross. And we've brought this one before you many times, the parable of the vineyard. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, built a watchtower. And he rented the vineyard to some farmers who moved into another place. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, stoned a third. Then he sent other servants to them, more than the first time. And the tenants treated him the same way. Last of all, he sent his son to them. They will respect my son, he said. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and take his inheritance. So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Now, if Jesus wasn't teaching about his own death and didn't know about his own death and that wasn't ascribing any meaning, why would he have told a story like this? That story is all about that. You know, here the story basically is the retelling of the story of Israel. God is the owner of the vineyard and the current ruling Jewish establishment of the tenants, and the prophets have come one after another, like John the Baptist. But which of the prophets did they not kill? John the Baptist being the last one that they sent to the vineyard, that God sent to the vineyard to give a reckoning, and they killed him, beheaded him. So now the Son shows up. Now who's the Son of God? The Messiah. Who is it? Jesus. And he shows up, and he knows what they're going to do to him. They're going to go, up, there's the heir. And they're going to kill him. Well, what's going to happen after they kill the son? A great judgment is going to come on the nation for them killing the heir. And that's exactly what he prophesied with the destruction of the temple. And indeed, it happened in 70 AD. So, the stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our own eyes. Even though they reject the Son, stone, remember those words, Ben and Eben are those play on words that are here. They reject the Son, which they're really rejecting the stone. They're rejecting the stone, which is the one, which is the cornerstone or the capstone of the temple. It falls on their heads as the poser builders. And the rightful and true builder is the Son, who will set the first stone for the temple and rebuild a new temple. All that imagery is there in that parable. It's a beautiful parable. And of course, the Pharisees know that they're talking about him and about them, and it makes them want to kill him. Another riddle of the cross is the great commandment. One of the teachers of the law comes and hears them debating, noticing that Jesus is giving them good answers. He asks them, of all the commandments, which is the most important? The most important one answered Jesus is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is the one Lord. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. Now that, of course, is the Shema, and every Israelite knows that one. Got it memorized and taped to their foreheads and wrapped around their arms and written on their doors and everywhere. The second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. Now, of course, a man says, well said, teacher. You are right in saying that God is one and that there is no other but him. To love him with all your heart, with all your understanding, and with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, here's the important thing, is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. Now, the fact that the guy adds that at the end about the relationship of loving God is much more important than the temple sacrifices. And what does Jesus say? When Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he says to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. And no one dared to ask him any more questions. It's a bit cryptic, but in a sense, Jesus is using that as an opportunity to say that the temple complex as it's currently fashioned is not what's important. And we're bringing about an age in which the Shema will be fulfilled in a way that's apart from the temple sacrifices and offerings. Now, you might think that's a stretch, so we'll keep going, and we'll see that he gets more specific. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar, poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. "Leave her alone," Jesus says. "She's done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them any time you want. But you will not always have me. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand." Now here's the riddle of the cross there. "Preparing for my burial. Truly I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she will be done will also be told in memory of her." Here Jesus alludes to again to his death, and that he is being anointed in a royal and regal kind of way in preparation for his burial. The riddle, this is a really interesting one. The green tree and the dry. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. And this is as he is on his way to the cross. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourself and for your children. For the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women, the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Now, what Jesus is actually alluding to here is a passage from the Old Testament. If the people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry? Now, what's the significance of this? Here they are crucifying Jesus. And he's basically telling these people who are crying, you think this is bad. It's going to get a lot worse. Because if they do this kind of thing while the tree is green, in other words, when it doesn't burn too well, what do you think's going to happen after everything's sort of reached its ripeness and fulfillment? What's it going to be like then? When the wood is dry, then it'll really burn. So what's he quoting? Hosea chapter 10. "Israel is a spreading vine. He has brought forth fruit for himself. And as his fruit has increased, he has built more altars, and his land has prospered. He adorned his sacred stones. Their heart is deceitful, and now they must bear their guilt. The Lord, Yahweh, will demolish their altars and destroy their sacred stones." So in other words, Yahweh is going to come in judgment at this fat cat Israel because they have prospered and in a sense rejected. The whole story of Hosea is the prophet Hosea marries a bride of unfaithfulness. I don't know if you remember that story, but it's a prophet is told to go and marry a prostitute. And of course, Hosea, that's scandalous. You know, here's a righteous man. You're telling me to go marry a prostitute? And God says to Hosea, "Do it and remain committed to her, because that is what I have done with the nation of Israel. I have been married to a prostitute. She is an unfaithful bride." So the Israelites will say, verse 3, "We have no king because we did not revere the Lord. But even if we had a king, what could he do for us?" Now, think about this kind of thing in light of the statements that the Jewish people made during the trial of Jesus and before Pilate. "We have no king but the emperor." Remember that one? Remember that line? "The high places of wickedness will be destroyed. It is the sin of Israel. Thorns and thistles will grow up. What was once a beautiful vineyard." Think about the parable of the vineyard. And the tenants of the vineyard. "The thorns and thistles will grow up and cover their altars. Then they will say to the mountains, 'Cover us,' and to the hills, 'Fall on us.'" That we're starting to get to the parts that Jesus was quoting to those wailing women. "When I please, I will punish them. Nations will be gathered against them to put them into the bonds for their double sin. But you have planted wickedness. You have reaped evil because you have eaten the fruit of deception, because you have depended on your own strength and on your many warriors." In other words, you've depended on your own military might and not on Yahweh to save you. The roar of battle will rise against your people so that all your fortresses will be devastated. As Shalman devastated Beth Athlon on the day of battle, when mothers were dashed to the ground with their children, so will it happen to you, Bethel, because your wickedness is great. When that day awaits, the king of Israel will be completely destroyed. Now, who's the king of Israel that will be destroyed? Jesus. He is the king, and he has come in that moment. Now, if that's what happens when the tree is green, that they here comes the king, what's going to happen when Israel ripens in that rebellious spirit towards Rome and those firebrands in the street that are being taught by those revolutionary fathers and mothers grow up into full-fledged firebrands? You're going to see some major revolution take place generations from now. And you mothers are going to weep and wail as those youngins that you have raised are all going to be slaughtered by the Romans. And it's coming. If they do this kind of thing, if they kill the king of Israel when the tree is green, what are they going to do when it's dry? Judgment is coming, and you better be ready for it. Here's another riddle of the cross, the hen and the chickens. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, he's standing on the Mount of Olives looking out over the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you. How often have I longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now the imagery here is there's danger in the farmyard. And why would a mother hen gather her chicks under her wings? There's danger, like a barnyard fire or an enemy in the farmyard. And so the mother hen wants to gather all the chicks under the wings to shelter the chicks in protection and take the brunt of the danger on herself and spare the chicks, her brood. Jesus is saying, O Israel, O Jerusalem, I wanted to gather you together and keep you under the shadow of my wings, but you would not be gathered. I would have borne the brunt of the wrath for myself, for you, but you would not be gathered. So see what happens? You have allowed yourself to remain unprotected out from underneath the covering of my wings. And today, and he switches metaphors, your house is left to you desolate. In other words, Yahweh has left the building. He was your guard. He was your protection. Well, here is the day of the visitation where he has come to shelter you under the shadow of his wings, and you would not be sheltered. And so now you are going to bear life without the protection of Yahweh. And I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now that is all about an image of a farmyard fire or some kind of danger where the chicks take shelter under the shadow of the wings. The hen may die, but the chicks are spared. Jesus believed that he would suffer the fate hanging over Jerusalem. He desired to take it on himself that she might avoid it, but she wouldn't have it. The fate of Jesus and Jerusalem are intricately locked together. Because of the abandonment of her proffered shelter, Israel is left defenseless. The house has been abandoned. Yahweh has left the temple. Psalm 118 is where that passage, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Psalm 18, just before that part, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, is where it says, the stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. And Psalm 118, if you go back and look at it, how much time? We only have 4 minutes. Psalm 118 is all about offering the shelter of Yahweh and then it being rejected, but it's still being available to those who receive it. So here Jesus is offering the protection of Yahweh. It's rejected. It's a stone that the builders have rejected, but it's nevertheless going to become the cornerstone of a new temple. And that's all there in Psalm 118, so that new cornerstone, that the stone that the builders rejected becoming the chief cornerstone, will become a day of celebration where people will say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hallelujah! because there's a new temple that is being brought up. Jesus himself envisioned himself as the true temple builder, coming in no ordinary pilgrimage to Jerusalem. The present temple, abandoned by Yahweh, was under threat of destruction, having refused the message of peace and his offer of escape. The only hope was to acknowledge him as the true pilgrim and to welcome him so that the stone rejected by the builders might indeed become the head of the corner. Take a look at Psalm 118 in your own time if you want. So Jesus, another riddle of the cross, the baptism in the cup language. Jesus says, I've come to bring fire on the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled. But I have a baptism to undergo, and what constraint I am under until it is completed. You remember he began his ministry with the symbol of baptism. And now he's saying, I'm going to end my ministry with the symbol of baptism. What was the symbol of baptism all about with John the Baptist doing baptism in the River Jordan? Why would John go out to the River Jordan to do those baptisms? What would that symbolize, that action? Do you know? Exactly. It's the end of the Exodus and the entry into the Promised Land. A new age is dawning. A day of land of milk and honey. So Jesus began his ministry going through the baptism of John and through the River Jordan, entering into the, again, reenacting that entrance into the Promised Land. Now he's saying, I have a baptism to undergo. And he's talking about his death here. But that death will be, in a sense, what brings about a new entrance into the Promised Land, a new exodus. And I wish that it were already kindled. Remember, John said he's going to baptize with fire. Remember the discussion of James and Jesus? You know, can we sit at the left hand and the right hand, and when you come to your power and greatness and glory in your kingdom, and Jesus asked them this question. Can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? And they say, woohoo, we can. Because what they have in mind is political, military power and glory. Jesus is thinking his death, his crucifixion and his suffering. Can you drink the cup? Can you be baptized with the baptism? We can, they answer. And Jesus says to him, well, you actually will drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism I baptize with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. So you actually are going to suffer in the same ways, he's telling them, but they don't really understand what they're asking for. Remember Jesus, when he prayed about the baptism in the cup. Abba, Father, he said in the Garden of Gethsemane, Everything is possible for you, but take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. What is this idea of the cup? Isaiah 51:17-23. Awake, awake, rise up, Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath. You who have drained to its dregs the goblet that makes people stagger. Among all the children she bore, there was none to guide her. Among all the children she reared, there was none to take her by her hand. So here Jesus is saying that he is going to drink the cup of the judgment of God. And he is going to bear that judgment. And remember, think back again to the idea of what he was offering to Jerusalem as the mother hen. I want to gather you, so I will take the wrath. I will take the judgment. Remember what it was that passed over the land of Egypt? It was the angel of death, the judgment of the Lord. But the blood that was over the doorpost, the lamb, was what sheltered the Israelites from that judgment, from that wrath. And so here Jesus is saying, I will drink that cup. I will bear that burden and do that and undergo that baptism. Everything that he was saying about his death was all tied up in those symbols and these kinds of prophetic statements found in the Old Covenant. Did the early church write these stories and riddles back into the history? It's hard to see how they would do that. Because number one, when you read the writings of the early church, like the Apostle Paul, they don't speak in riddles. They speak plainly about the significance and meaning of Jesus' death. There's none of this kind of cryptic language and so forth. It has the ring of truth about it in that way, that Jesus would have been the one that would have spoken in those kind of riddles. The early church fully integrated and fully interpreted all of these passages and plainly spoke about the nature of atonement and the theology of atonement in very developed ways. There is not a developed atonement theology in these riddles, as we find in Paul's letter to the Romans, for example. Jesus' death was anticipated and expected by Jesus. The main signpost for that is the Lord's Supper, and it's hard to argue that that didn't happen historically. Jesus' own death, the death of the strange non-messianic Messiah, was somehow bound up both with the fate of the nation and with the coming new Exodus, in which Yahweh would at last establish his kingdom. So I want to just end by reading you a list of the predictions of Jesus that he made about his own death. And I'll just let you sit with these, and we're going to pick up next week developing this a little bit more. But just listen to what Jesus said about his own coming death, and we'll end with this and with a prayer. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days be raised. How then is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? He was teaching the disciples that the Son of Man will be given into the hands of men, and that they will kill him, and that he will rise again 3 days after his death. Taking the 12, he began to tell them what was to happen to him. Look, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and to the scribes, who will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles. They will scourge him, spit at him, flog him, and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise again. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. You will all fall away because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. For I tell you, this thing that is written must be fulfilled in me. And he was numbered among the lawless, for that which concerns me has its fulfillment. The hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. All this, i.e. Jesus' arrest, has taken place so that the scriptures might be fulfilled. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the gift of your Son Jesus, who came to die on a cross for our salvation and redemption. And indeed, he has offered, not only to his people Israel, but to every single person in this world, that if they would merely come underneath the shadow of his wings as a mother hen gathers her chicks in a farmyard danger, that they would find protection and salvation while the mother hen bears the price of the danger. We thank you that you have passed over us and spared us your judgment. You have passed over us and dealt a mighty blow to our enemies, the Satan and all the spiritual forces of evil. We thank you for the gift of your Son Jesus and the redemption in his blood. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, we'll stop right there. We're past.